On Tech News Today, now Amazon has another thing in common with Apple. Companies being investigated for cheating on Euro taxes. Plus, the Nobel Prize goes to the inventors of a technology you probably use every day. A major Apple partner goes bankrupt, and the feds say it's okay to use the pictures they found on a suspect's phone to create a fake Facebook identity. All that and more coming up right now on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, October 7th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. And Jason Howell, how the heck are you?
I'm hanging in there. Had my PB&J sandwich in the car on the way, so I'm well fed and ready to talk tech.
Hey, you know what? That's a meal for every single meal, breakfast, lunch, and or dinner.
It's actually one of the perks of being a parent is that you get to rediscover peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Do you cut the crusts off your own sandwich?
No, I keep that crust on there. It's good stuff. Right. Nutritious.
It's where all the vitamins are. Yeah. And with speaking of vitamins, Joe Panettiere is with us. It's our Tuesday gift, our treat. What do we call it? Thank you so much for joining us today again, Joe Panettiere.
Smooth transition.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. And here on the East Coast, it's also PB&J Day, but we cut our sandwiches diagonally, just a little different. So yeah, it's
a new slant.
Quite a good meal.
Yeah, terrible. So, you know, Joe, I wanted to talk to you about Steve Levy's new joint. It's called Medium. He hinted at it when we had him on as a guest some time ago. But of course, Medium, people are familiar with the site Medium, which is a sort of a newish kind of journalistic endeavor. And Steve Levy has been made the editor-in-chief of Backchannel. Backchannel is essentially, it's a long-form, let's face it, it's a long-form journalism site. What do you think of what he's saying so far, Joe?
You know, I love the concept, and I'll tell you a couple of reasons why. I think we're seeing a trend of seasoned journalists who are trying to do meatier, long-form content that's deeply researched. And instead of trying to cover every story of the day, Steven's just going to focus on a few with his team that are much more thoroughly investigated. So I like that approach, number one, on the content front. Number two, in terms of design, I think one of the things we're seeing is over the past 5 to 7 years, so many IT media sites in particular have gotten so cluttered. It's almost impossible to navigate all their top 10 lists on these various sites. Steven's approach and the whole Medium approach is let's get rid of the clutter and get you right to the content. The whole idea is to get you much closer to the content and eliminate that frustration and navigation. So I think he's onto something here. The big question as always is how are you going to monetize this, Steven? And I'll be watching for those answers.
Absolutely. And he brings to attention to the fact that there are multiple types of journalism. I think the casual reader can tell, hey, this is a great article, or, you know, that's kind of a boring article, or my eyes are glazing over, whatever. What's really happening behind the scenes is there's a minority of journalists. Let's face it, there's a minority of journalists who are getting scoops. They're writing original content, very original opinions and analysis pieces. And then there's legions of underpaid bloggers and reporters who are just banging out pickups, what we call pickups.
Right.
And they're essentially reading one person's article and then writing a version of their own just so the website has a cheap version of that story. The difference between those stories is night and day. And it's really the people who are doing good journalism. You know, sometimes something starts out to be a pickup and it ends up being a great piece because the journalist adds something really valuable to it. And that's one of the things we do on this show, if you haven't noticed. We go find the journalists who are doing good journalism. So if somebody's on this show, you know that we believe that they are a really excellent journalist and that they've done some really original work. And so we try to highlight that and also point out to you the difference between the pickup journalism and real journalism. And we're glad, and I'm personally glad that Steven Levy is making a big deal out of that as well and just focusing exclusively on the really, really good, high quality long form journalism.
Yeah, it's refreshing. I think the other thing with Levy is there's actually some help wanted ads. I saw at least one of them up on the site for an executive editor working with Steven. So if you take a look at that ad and some of the other things going on the site, it gives you even more clues about what he's up to before the contents even arrive. So it's fun to poke around the site and pick up those clues in terms of where he's going, Mike.
Absolutely. Well, just let's jump into the news. Speaking of news, the European Commission is looking into whether Amazon got illegal help from Luxembourg to dodge taxes. Amazon records most of its European profit with a subsidiary in Luxembourg where the profit is not fully taxed. This is just like the Apple case, Joe Panettiere, where essentially, I love this because it's essentially Europe is going, you American tech company, you're breaking the law with a European country, and so us, Europe, are going to crack down on the both of you. And so what this is really about is they've noticed there's sort of a discomfort level in the public opinion in Europe about the pain and suffering caused by austerity measures and on the one hand, and on the other hand, lots of companies are not paying much in taxes. They're not really paying their fair share, and they're doing it through various loopholes. Typically, companies want to incentivize location and business within their own country, pretty much at the expense of the other countries within the European Union. And in the case of Apple, in exchange for jobs, they provided Apple with a very favorable tax structure. And then they can funnel a lot of their European profits and so on through that one country instead of having to pay individually on all these different countries. And so, you know, they're, you know, again, this is not they have not been prosecuted or found guilty or anything like that. They announced the beginning of an investigation.
Yeah, you know, and we're seeing this over and over again, particularly in European countries, where it's a case of number one, find the money, and then number two, collect the money. I mean, it's almost like a game of Risk, right? Where you're moving your employees and your board pieces around the board on Risk, and the various countries are saying, well, how much of that is in our country, and how much can we collect on that? And before you know it, the vendor once again is trying to move the board pieces again to another country. And it's just a game of cat and mouse over and over again.
Yeah, and I wonder if it could end up hurting Europe in the end, because if they really crack down on this sort of thing, a lot of business might be moved out of Europe entirely, and that's not necessarily a good thing for Europe either. But we'll keep watching this story as it unfolds, as they go their investigation. It should only take them about 50 years to prosecute. I'm kidding. Europe is a very slow-moving beast. So this is not going to happen immediately. But, you know, there'll be news trickling out about this, and we will cover it when it does. Well, in just a minute, we're going to tell you who won the Nobel Prize, and they won it for inventing something that you probably use every day and that you might be using right now. But first, I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is the best way to hire great people. And let me tell you about hiring great people. I've hired lots of people in my day, and I'm telling you, that's the difference between success and failure. That's the one decision you make as a hiring manager, as a business owner, is who you hire. If you hire the wrong people, you're going to end up with a crew of people who are unqualified and unmotivated and don't really know what they're doing. If you hire the best people, you're going to have the best company by definition. So ZipRecruiter helps you do that, and here's how they do it. They solve the problem of the fact that, you know, the qualified candidates are everywhere. They don't all congregate in one single place. And so ZipRecruiter lets you post your job to 50-plus job sites. And these include Craigslist, LinkedIn, Twitter. You know, it includes job sites and social networks. You can find candidates in any city, industry, or nationwide. You can just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. And then once these candidates roll in, ZipRecruiter will help you separate the wheat from the chaff. They'll show you the qualified candidates, and they won't waste your time with the unqualified candidates, which is very, very important because they're really, really casting a wide net. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And remember, that's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. Well, Joe, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics?
Well, Mike, let me answer your question with a question. When was the last time you heard about a Nobel Prize victory that actually it involves some sort of practical implication in your home or in your office right now? Any recollection?
No, it's usually for some kind of like theoretical thing that's you know, out in the universe. There's a string dark theory thing, and it's like, you're like, what?
Yeah, so, maybe no, it's an antimatter thing.
Yeah.
Well, this time around, we've got something that actually pertains to probably all of our listeners and viewers today. It involves the inventors of the LED light, a low energy technology. And here with some details is Stephen Shanklin, the senior editor over at CNET News. Hey, Stephen, you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hey, great to have you aboard today. Thanks for joining us. Hey, can you give us a little bit of an overview? First of all, the big picture, who are these inventors who won the prize? And number two, what do they actually invent here?
Okay, there are three guys. They were all working in Japan at the time in the 1980s and the 1990s when they figured this out. Somewhat independent efforts. They are Isamu Akasaki and Hiroshi Amano and Shuji Nakamura. These guys were working at Nagoya University and at a private company, and they worked out something that's very important, which is how to make an LED shine blue light. LEDs are all over the place. They're these little electronic diodes that produce light when you put a little bit of electrical current across them, and you're familiar with them all over. But where you see them right now is most usefully is in your laptop screen, in your smartphone, in new LED light bulbs that use very little electricity, in street lamps that use very little electricity. You see them on brake lights in cars. You see them on blinking crosswalk signs. So it was very easy, comparatively speaking, to make red ones and green ones. Once you made the blue ones, you could mix all three of those colors of light together and get white light. So that's when it moved away from, you know, little blinking lights on the side of the computer that are, you know, useful, to actual white light that you could use for illumination everywhere. The reason that's important is because LED light uses vastly less electricity for a given amount of light than incandescent light bulbs or even than fluorescent light bulbs. So by moving to LED lighting, you save a lot of electricity, and therefore you save a lot of money. You help the environment.
Now, Stephen, can you talk about besides prizes, I mean, they get about $1.1 million to split between the three of them. But how have they been rewarded for this invention? I mean, there are hundreds or maybe thousands of companies that are making, you know, unmeasurable amounts of money off of this invention. How much have they been paid ultimately for inventing this amazing technology?
Yeah, I'm not sure in the case of Akasaki and Amano. Those are the two guys who worked at Nagoya University. But some of the later developments, specifically with blue light LEDs and blue light lasers, came from Nakamura. And he was working at a Japanese company at the time called Nichia Chemical Corporation. He got paid $200 for his work, which he patented. And the company got a huge amount of money, millions and millions and millions of dollars from patent licensing royalties. So this was this actually turned out to be controversial, because at the time there was a prevailing cultural ethos in Japan, the salaryman ethos. You work for the company, you dedicate your life to the company, and the company succeeds or not. And he came to the United States, and he discovered that he didn't think he was being compensated fairly. So he sued for something like $200 million. He eventually prevailed, although he only got about $8 million out of it. So it's kind of a controversial case, because he really shook up the social status quo in Japan. So he's somebody who, you know, was willing to push the envelope over his invention.
Now, why do you suppose that it took him this long to award it to them? I mean, there hasn't been anything new in recent years. Are they just a super slow-moving organization?
You know, it's funny that the Nobel Prize organization is actually the Swedish Royal. Oh, I can't even remember. But they do move deliberately. I would hesitate to say slowly. There are some things that they can, you know, immediately reward. But for example, last year, the award was for the Higgs boson. This is one of these abstract theoretical physics things that you probably have no idea what it means. It took a very long time. About half a century from the prediction of the Higgs boson to actually turn into the discovery and verification of the Higgs boson. So they weren't willing to give that award until they had actual concrete proof that arrived that the Higgs boson existed. When it comes to something like LEDs, I actually spoke to the head of the American Institute of Physics, and this was on their short list of candidates, of things that could get the award. And certainly, you know, they could have given this earlier, but it takes a little while sometimes for them to have a slot in the Nobel Prize calendar that doesn't need to go to something more urgent, and also for something to prove itself as truly influential. So in the case of the blue LEDs, which leads to white LED light, that's really only taking off now as a big thing. The costs are coming down enough and the commercialization is spreading fast enough that it's an important thing now. 5 years ago, it was very interesting technology, but it really wasn't affecting nearly as much as it is today. So I think the timing is actually, you know, pretty good for them, because this is really when LEDs are coming into their own.
Well, they didn't get fairly compensated, but they will always have our undying gratitude. Stephen Shanklin is at CNET.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at STShank. Thanks for joining us, Stephen Shanklin.
Thank you.
Apple's partner for the making of Sapphire displays has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The move comes less than a year after it signed a $578 million deal with Apple. Ben Fox Rubin is a reporter at CNET, and he joins us now. Welcome to you, Ben Fox Rubin.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. Thank you. Is the company in trouble? Or are they at risk of going out of business?
I would say Chapter 11 bankruptcy would definitely describe the fact that they could certainly go out of business, and something went wrong over there and went wrong very badly. So I think they're in a lot of trouble.
Hey, Ben, in terms of something, quote unquote, going wrong very badly, can you connect the dots with us potentially between this event and then the iPhone 6 launch? Like a lot of us expected a sapphire screens at some point with the iPhone 6, but we're not seeing them. Was that part of the original plan? Did it get scrapped? Is there anything going on here in terms of the business relationship?
There were a lot of expectations throughout 2014 for, you know, basically ever since that this first got announced in November 2013, this $578 million deal. And a lot of folks, industry watchers, reporters, investors were all expecting some sort of big sapphire use case in the iPhone 6. And when that didn't happen, GT Advanced, which is the company that was making Sapphire for Apple, their stock started to slide from, in early September, $17 a share to $11 a share as of Friday. After they announced Chapter 11 bankruptcy, their shares are now trading at around $1 a share. So this was a huge expectations game kind of thing. I mean, like, a lot of folks thought that there was going to be something relating to Sapphire on that iPhone 6. And I think that perhaps Apple was too. I mean, they just don't talk that much about, you know, their product. So it's really hard to actually ascertain what exactly is going on here. But the factory that they created was, I think it was something along the lines of 1.3 million square feet, which is many, many football fields in size. It was supposed to increase the size of Sapphire production by, you know, at least one or two times what is already being created worldwide. So this was a very big bet on Sapphire, and a lot of people did expect that to happen with the iPhone 6.
And in addition to 1.3 million square foot facility, that's in Mesa, Arizona, they have 700 employees. Now, the worst case scenario, just to revisit this concept, seems to me something like this. Apple got into bed with GT Advanced Technologies, said, we're going to reinvent Sapphire displays, how they're manufactured. We're going to bring down the cost. They're making larger, you know, basically they have to grow the Sapphire in these larger units. We're going to build this colossal Sapphire facility, and we're going to put Sapphire on everything. And then it seems to me that at some point, Apple may have changed their minds, or maybe it wasn't ready, or there was some other problem. And essentially, GT was left holding the bag on this thing. They invested all this money into this manufacturing facility, and it seems like Apple's going, well, you know, what are you going to do? Does this make Apple look bad on the one hand, because it looks like Apple kind of allowed their partner who invested so much money to essentially dangle in the wind financially, you know, basically just barely hanging on financially all of a sudden? And also, it's kind of like, you know, partner and go all in with Apple and you go bankrupt. Like, it's kind of bad for their reputation, isn't it?
It's that is, Mike, I think, certainly a theory of what may have happened, that Apple kind of got cold feet and decided that Sapphire wasn't good enough for the iPhone 6. And that's what caused it to happen. One of the other things that I'm hearing from analysts is an entirely different storyline, that Apple could still very much be interested in doing Sapphire in their phones in the future. However, GT Advance just wasn't a great supplier. They overpromised. They said that they were going to bring it in at a certain price, which they didn't end up doing. They said that they could have it ready at the time of this launch, which they didn't end up doing. And Apple got really upset about it and decided to walk, cut them off, and that forced them into Chapter 11 bankruptcy. I mean, that is the other storyline that a lot of folks are at least considering at this point. I think yours is also a possibility, and hopefully the you know, what's actually going to happen during the bankruptcy will hopefully provide at least a little bit more nuance or information as to what exactly happened here. I think there are a lot more question marks than there are answers at this point as to what happened. And I think it's very worthwhile to say that a company's stock doesn't just tank like that, where it goes down 93% in one day. It lost $1.5 billion in market value in the course of, you know, just in the early time of it trading. This was a huge surprise in the market. So there were a lot of folks that were expecting a lot more from this company, and it just kind of went kaput. And I think people are still looking for a lot of answers as to what exactly happened here.
Right. So, Ben, two-part follow-up question for you is, you're going to have some fun in the next few weeks, I think, diving through SEC filings of about this story.
But my two-part court filings, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. My two-part question is, number one, do you think GT has alternative revenue sources going forward where they might be able to diversify fast? And part two, does Apple have an alternative supplier lined up for Sapphire? Can you tell us anything on either of those points?
For GT Advance, from what I understand, this was actually creating Sapphire was a new area for them before they were making the equipment that then other folks were then using to make the Sapphire. So, you know, maybe that's going to make them enough money, but they went pretty deeply into debt trying to prepare the supply line for Apple. So we'll see if the rest of their business is able to make up for those losses otherwise. But it'll be a pretty hard row. As far as whether Apple can find another Sapphire supplier, the whole point of them making this deal with GT Advanced was because there just wasn't enough supply in the open market for what they wanted to do. So one would assume that they would have to create a completely new sweetheart deal with somebody else, like a completely different supplier, if they actually expected to develop this much Sapphire. Like I said, this was a huge facility in Arizona, and that amount of Sapphire doesn't just fall from the sky. So there are other suppliers out there that make Sapphire. There are plenty of them, but you can't just end up, you know, buying this much stuff on the open market.
Why don't they just buy GT? I mean, they spend that kind of money on security for their spaceship campus site every day. I mean, just, you know, write a check and they can own the whole thing, all the equipment, the factory, all of it.
Why didn't they do that already, though? You know, this was a very small company comparatively to Apple. And I had always wondered, you know, why make this sweetheart deal in the first place? I think what you could point to is the fact that this was a bet on Sapphire. Apple was willing to put down, you know, $578 million in its chits. And it was structured in such a way that Apple could walk away at some point. So I don't know that they want to own GT Advanced. If they did, they probably would have bought them already. Apple has more money than virtually every other company there is out there.
Yeah, and of course, if they did want to buy them, now's the time because their stock price has tanked. Ben Fox Rubin is at CNET.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Ben Fox Rubin. Thank you so much for joining us, Ben.
Much appreciated. Thanks, Mike.
Well, Joe, the Korean users of messaging services were recently delivered some bad news by their own government. What do they do about it?
There may be some bad news and now some good news coming. So this story, Mike, really shows how privacy concerns can trigger a mass user exodus from one app to another. This time, as you pointed out, it involved South Korea and the government allegedly spying on their citizens, and then a German app provider stepping in and potentially providing a rescue app here. Here with the details is Russell Brandon, a reporter from The Verge. Russell, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am.
Hey, it's great to have you aboard. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Russell, tell us, what is going on in South Korea where so many users are so concerned about privacy right now? What triggered this concern?
So there had been a lot of, a lot of people have been criticizing the South Korean president, Park Geun-hye. Hope I'm saying that right. I think this had been sort of going on for a while and tension had kind of been building. The government wasn't super happy about all the criticism. And then 2 weeks ago, I think there was sort of a breaking point and the president said, look, this is against the law to insult the president and sort of rumor mongering. I think South Korea has very different rules about that than exist in America. And she essentially announced, listen, if you say this through these various channels, we have prosecutors out looking for cases. And if you say this, they'll take you to court over it. And particularly that included the very popular chat program KakaoTalk, in which the vast majority of South Korean cell phone users uses. People had sort of assumed that this was private in the way that you would think, a message you sent over iMessage or WhatsApp. You sort of assume that this is between you and the person that you sent the message to. And suddenly the government was telling you, listen, this is, our prosecutors can also see this.
The numbers on this are astonishing. The number of users who have left KakaoTalk is around 400,000 in the past week. And the number of people who have downloaded Telegram is 1 million. Is the government...
A million and a half, according to... That was I talked to the Telegram people yesterday, and they told me, in the past week, they've gotten a million and a half signups, which, I think it's good news for any startup. Whatever the reasons behind it. In this case, the reason happens to be privacy.
That would be a big number even in China, but in tiny South Korea, that's an incredible number. And I can't believe that the government would just allow a German app to come in and replace the one that they're sort of hacking, if you will. What do you think they're going to do about this? Do you think they're going to crack down on Telegram?
I think they'll have a hard time doing that. I mean, there's actually, I refer to it, the servers are based in Germany, but the founder, it's actually an interesting story. He founded VK, which is the Russian equivalent of Facebook. It looks very much like Facebook, but had some problems with the Russian government with VK and left Russia sort of essentially permanently. And the thing he wanted to do was create an encrypted chat program because he had such a bad experience with the government in Russia. So I think if they did try to shut down Telegram, it would be very, very difficult for them. They would have to institute some really serious internet controls that I think would escalate this, situation even more. So I don't know. It's possible they'll try to do that. But I think at this point, they have to let South Korea vote with their feet,
Yeah, in terms of the messaging coming out of Telegram right now, they've been using so big social media channels like Twitter, for instance, to entice those South Korean users over to their platform, number one. And number two, could you also read some of those tweets as sort of like basically, I don't know the right word here, but potentially ruffling the feathers of the Korean government? I mean, how did you read those tweets when you saw them?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a challenge. They are saying, if you're unhappy with the South Korean government, and I think a lot of South Koreans, that's the sort of ultimate reason behind all of this, is a lot of people are saying, listen, this president doesn't know what she's doing. And then you have, they really want to say that, and the government's making it very, very hard for them to say that and feel safe and feel like they're not going to get thrown in jail or get their friends thrown in jail. And I think Telegram is being very canny, tapping into that and saying, listen, we're a great way to do that. If you want to do that and make sure that you're only sending the message to the people that you mean to be sending the message to.
And I think apps like Telegram that provide some kind of security one way or the other is the future. And nothing says the future like the word Telegram. kind of an odd name there. Russell Brandom writes at TheVerge.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Russell Brandom. Thank you so much for joining us, Russell.
Yeah, my pleasure.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, is defending its impersonation of a woman on Facebook. An exclusive by investigative reporter Chris Hamby on BuzzFeed found that the DEA created the fake account of a real person without her knowledge or permission. The agency used her real pictures, too, which they had taken from her seized cell phone when she was previously arrested. They also posted pictures of her son and niece. Chris Hamby joins us to talk about his exclusive. Welcome to you, Chris Hamby.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, what did the DEA use the woman's identity and fake Facebook account for?
It's not completely clear how this was used in the investigation, but they have acknowledged that they used it to send out a friend request to a fugitive and to accept friend requests from other people. And then other than that, they've only specified that it was used as part of a legitimate law enforcement investigation, as they characterize it.
How do they gain access to her phone and her photos for this operation?
So she was originally arrested and suspected of being part of this drug ring in upstate New York. And it actually turned out that she was in a relationship with the man who was, authorities believed, the head of this drug ring. She was not particularly involved. Her involvement was fairly minimal. And a judge later just sentenced her to probation. She was essentially a bit player in this whole thing. But during that arrest, they did seize her cell phone, and then they used that cell phone to create this Facebook page.
That is creepy, I got to tell you. So what did experts on privacy law tell you about this particular case?
They pretty much unanimously found it very disturbing. That it raises one of the key points here is the Justice Department's argument in their legal filings as to why they're allowed to do this, which is that she implicitly consented to allowing this Facebook page to be created by allowing the search of her phone, which the experts that I spoke to almost unanimously felt like that was a one said a dangerous expansion of the notion of consent. It really, taken to the extreme, think about all the stuff that we have on our smartphones now. I mean, if the government could use consent to search a phone to use anything on that phone for any purpose, that has potentially very far-reaching implications.
Now, what about her child's photo? Is that also involved here? And how are they trying to justify that?
So, yes, the agent, they've acknowledged that the agent did post a photo that included the woman's young son and her young niece. And they have not articulated a specific defense of that aside from the general defense of creating this page, which I just outlined. But this is being put forward by the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of New York.
Now, why is this story just now emerging? This is a few years old, isn't it? These events took place some time ago.
It is. So this page was actually created in 2010, and this might not have come to light had not the woman involved actually sued the DEA agent and the government in this case. And so then, of course, the government was forced to respond to this, and that's where they acknowledged doing this in court filings. There's no real indication of whether this was an isolated case or not, and the Department of Justice flatly refused to speak with me on that.
Chris Hamby is at BuzzFeed.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Chris D. Hamby. Thanks for joining us on Tech News Today, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Well, just a sec, we're going to get some new information about Facebook's growing problem with their acquisition of WhatsApp, but first, I want to tell you about the greatest place in the world to build a website, which is Squarespace, of course. Squarespace is a place where you can build a beautiful website, a website that's never going to go down, no matter how popular you are. And it's going to be super, super easy to use. You don't have to be a design genius to have a beautifully designed site. You don't have to be an engineering genius to have a beautifully engineered site. All you have to do is go to Squarespace and sign up for an account, and it's extremely affordable, about $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. Now, you start with 25 templates. These are incredibly well-designed templates, and then you can customize them, add your own content, of course. You can create a blog or any sort of site. You can sell things. You can create a, start a business or collect money for your nonprofit, whatever you want to do. All subscription plan levels include e-commerce, so it's very, very simple to do, and it's very, very powerful. All these features you see on the biggest websites, you can implement yourself for your little website, and you can grow your little website into a big website because Squarespace will always give you room to grow. And of course, it's mobile ready. You can manage your blog or your website from a mobile device. It's super easy to do. And of course, when your readers and followers go to your website, they're going to see a beautiful site if they look at it on their phone, on their tablet, no matter what device they're looking at it with. It's going to be redesigned on the fly for those sites with this flexible rendering. It's just an amazing service. Now, start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT because that will get you 10% off the price. And you can also use that to show your support for Tech News Today. And we thank Squarespace for their support of this show. And remember that a better web awaits and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, Joe, new information about Facebook's $19 billion acquisition of WhatsApp. What's up?
Yeah, what's up is the price. That's what's up. It's now $22 billion. The reason it's gone from 19 to $22 billion over the last year is basically this was mostly a stock deal, a stock transaction. And as Facebook shares rose, so too did the value of this deal. Now, what's interesting about this is the earnout period or the lockup period for WhatsApp founder John Combe. I think he's locked up for nearly $2 billion in Facebook stock. And that, you know, he's got to stick around, Mike, not for 1 year, not for two, not for three, but 4 years under this term. So we'll be seeing how that pans out for him.
Having to work at Facebook for 4 years is the bad news. The good news is when you have a deal like this, you can do anything you want. You can show up drunk and naked, and it's like, you know, they can't fire you, and you still get your $2 billion. So it's like, you know, he's got it made. Just got to stick it out for 4 years of goofing off. I don't know if you see the HBO show Silicon Valley, but they show these people that are part of an acquisition and they don't really have jobs or roles for them. So they just go up on the roof of the building and have a barbecue every single day and just wait to collect the money.
I want to know how that gig works out because our last company, we got acquired by Penton Media, great parent. We were there. Myself and the co-founder stayed there for 2 years. But no, it was not a barbecue and it was not a country club. It was a lot of work for 2 years. So, yeah, maybe the next round I'll get a country club deal, but I don't know.
Somebody that you and I once worked with, I won't obviously mention his name on the air, but he told me that after he stopped working at CMP, where you and I both worked, he went off to work for another company and, you know, various things happened. And then there were layoffs and laid off a bunch of people, but they forgot to lay him off. They did lay off his supervisor and they just didn't know that he was there. So he showed up every day. He would read magazines and make calls and stuff like that. And finally, he just got super bored and left. But he worked for a year without any responsibilities, no assignments, nothing. So
sounds like a modern media strategy to me.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of WhatsApp, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg had to use the WhatsApp app to communicate with Oculus VR CEO Brendan Eribe. The reason is that Eribe, like many Facebook users, didn't want to install the separate Facebook Messenger app on his phone. Eribe said that in an interview this week that the deal was mostly negotiated via WhatsApp. That's pretty incredible. They're sitting there chatting these huge deals back and forth. Absolutely incredible. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Flavian Wen in Toulouse, France, who listens to TNT by controlling it with his Pebble smartwatch. And there's the Pebble smartwatch watching episode 1106. Look at that. That is so cool. How do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of your setup or yourself and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT and we'll find it. And that is the tech news today. Jason and Joe, what a big day today. I think this is the second day. We didn't have a big security story today either, did we? Not really.
Well, there's that minor one with the, well, I shouldn't call it minor if you were violated, but it involved the AT&T employee. basically hacking into, what was it, 1,500 or 15,000 accounts? I forget.
Yep. No information was stolen, and AT&T was quick to say, we fired him. He's gone. So what are you going to do? Well, Joe Panettiere, thank you so much. How's your new venture going for you?
It's going great. You know, we small steps. We're building sort of the foundation right now. We just launched the daily newsletter yesterday, and we're dropping some hints. We haven't said what we're doing next, but whatever we're up to next, it's coming in Q4.
Awesome. And by the way, that is built on Squarespace. Your website is built on Squarespace, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Just to give you a little bit of background on that, readers who follow me know that I've been sort of a WordPress geek for about 5 to 7 years now. Really love WordPress. But then, you know, as we were building our company, I was just looking for something that was scalable, repeatable, well-designed, and didn't have all the rough edges of WordPress. And WordPress has a lot of rough edges. And I think it was probably after speaking with you just a little bit, and then a weekend beta, I would call it, we switched to Squarespace, and it's been a great experience. We love it. I think one of the things that that you may not have covered as you were talking about is the SEO, the search engine optimization, and the integration with whether it's Google Search or Google Analytics, even Bing integrating into that, it's been great for us.
Yeah, I love it. I've been using it for a long time. I don't even remember if I heard about it from an ad that Leo did some time ago on Twitter, something like that. I don't recall. It probably was. But yeah, I really have fun with that. So anyway, Joe Panettiere, well, thank you so much. We will see you next Tuesday.
Thank you very much for having me. Take care.
All right. Well, you got to subscribe to Tech News Today because it's super convenient. And if you're around and have nothing to do and you want to learn more about technology, just fire up that subscription on your phone and listen to it or watch it or whatever you want to do. You can subscribe to the RSS feed. You can subscribe to Yahoo, Feedly, YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, you name it. So many ways to subscribe. Just go to twit.tv/TNT. You can also follow us on Twitter, Tech News Today TV, and we'll remind you when the live show is coming up. And please send us your thoughts and opinions. Just send email to tnt@twit.tv. Leave voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific. Tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name is Mike Elgin. Thank you for tuning in, and we will see you tomorrow.